Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Mark Bowden, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Best Game Ever, Giants vs. Colts, 1958 and the Birth of the Modern NFL, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. In the weeks to come, we have David Robolewski, Jeff Shara, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Just a moment, it's time to begin.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. It is through your support and patronage that we continue to bring you so many great authors to the Denver area. I am pleased to introduce tonight's guest speaker, best-selling author, Mark Bowden. Mark is a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and, of course, the author of international bestseller Black Hawk Down, which I'm sure you all remember went on to become a pretty big movie. Tonight, Mark is here to present his new book, The Best Game Ever, so please join me in welcoming Mark Bowden.
Thank you. Thank you, Beth. Well, thank you very much for coming. It's always a real pleasure to come to the Tattered Cover. This is my first time in this store. I guess the other one was the older version of this, a big old building with a staircase up the middle, which I thought was pretty cool. So I'm sorry that's not around anymore, but this one looks pretty impressive. I've done many things in my career as a writer. Most of my career was spent in newspapers. And during 1 3-year period at the Philadelphia Inquirer, I was the football writer. I covered the Philadelphia Eagles. And I figured that over the course of those 3 years, I probably wrote anywhere from 60 to 70 game stories of everything from Super Bowls to preseason games. And I don't know if any of you are familiar, but the way that you work as a sports writer covering a football game, you essentially watch the game and take notes, and you're handed statistics of the game as it unfolds. And then at the end of the game, you run downstairs into the locker rooms and try and grab a couple players and get a couple quotes from them, and maybe go to the coach's press conference for a few minutes to listen to him. And then you hustle back upstairs, and you hastily write an account of the game for the next day's newspaper. It's an art, but every time I did it, I wondered, the idea appealed to me, of having the opportunity at some point to really report and write a story about a football game, because they are tremendously complex events, and you don't begin to really understand them until you have a chance to study the film, because everything happens so fast. So I'm telling you right now, the breakdowns that you get in the newspaper the next day and that you see on ESPN are often wrong in their analyses of what happened. I always had this fantasy of being able to take as much time as I wanted, study the film, particularly study the film with coaches who really understood the strategy and tactics of the game and what players were trying to do, and also then interview players in depth and try to arrive at a better understanding of exactly what happened in that game, and then try to tell the story of it. And so that was nothing that I ever had a chance to do, but it was in my mind as a project that would be kind of fun. And so a few years ago, after I wrote a book about the Iran hostage crisis called Guest to the Ayatollah, which had taken me 5 years to do, and a lot of foreign travel and hundreds of interviews and boxes of research, my publisher gently suggested that I didn't have to spend 5 years on every one, you know, and that maybe it would be fun to occasionally do a story that would be fun to do, that wouldn't necessarily, you know, take me all over the world, and that I could maybe finish in a year or two, you know. And so we were kicking around ideas, and he mentioned that the 50th anniversary of this game was coming up. Now, it clicked with me, because I felt, you know, if I was ever going to actually do that, enact that fantasy of writing a book about a football game, that this would be the game to do, because it was it has long been regarded as the most important professional football game ever played. It was pronounced by the commissioner of the NFL, Bert Bell, and by the famous Sports Illustrated writer Tex Mall, and a whole lot of other people in the days after it was played, the greatest game that they had ever seen, or the greatest game in the history of football. And it has remained over the years a game that is considered to have been, by many football historians and football fans, the greatest game ever. If you go, for instance, to the NFL website, they have a great website, and the NFL Hall of Fame website in particular, you'll see this game described as the greatest professional football game ever played. So I decided that this would be a lot of fun to do, and started working on it, I guess, about a year and a half ago, and found out, I guess, all the reasons why this was such a great football game. I think in order to qualify any game, to qualify for being called the best game ever, it would have to, number one, be a really exciting football game. And that this was. This was a game that was played between the best defense in the NFL, which at the time was the New York Giants, and the best offense in the NFL, which was John Unitas. These were unquestionably the two best teams in the league in 1958. And they fought fittingly to a draw at the end of regulation time, and then played the first overtime game in the history of the NFL, the first sudden death overtime. The concept had been sketched out by Bert Bell some years before on the theory that you couldn't end a championship game, or you shouldn't end a championship game, on a tie. And it had long been the practice in professional football and in college, I believe, that when games ended and if the score was tied, that was it. It went in the record books as a tie. And Bert Bell had argued, no, you can't end a championship game on a tie, and had sketched out a procedure, a coin toss and a sudden death format for an overtime period, and this was only for championship games, and so it had never come up before 1958, and so it was such a novelty that a lot of the players had no idea that they were going to be asked to continue playing. I remember Sam Huff, the great middle linebacker for the Giants, was telling me that as he was trotting off the field at the end of the fourth quarter, after the Colts kicked the field goal that tied the game in the final seconds, just a death-defying drive, 80 yards to tie it up. He was not so much disappointed as he was relieved, because he was exhausted. It was freezing. They had played a brutal game, and the winners from each team were each going to take home $4,700. The losers were going to get like $3,100. So Huff says he's figuring, well, if we tie, you know, that means we're probably each going to get like $4,000. You know, that's better than losing. And you know, it was a great game, and he's feeling pretty good about himself until the referee runs over to the sidelines and says, okay, you guys, 3 minutes and we're going to kick off again. And Huff was not the only one who was a little disappointed to hear that he was going to have to go back out there and face these guys again. They had been frustrating him, in the case of Sam, for a long time in the second half. Some of the players had actually left the field, and they were called back. So it was a real novelty, and one of the benefits of the game going into overtime was that back then they started these professional games on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock because of blue laws in most cities. So the game started at 2. It took place on December 28th, so it got dark early. And so here was a game now that, because it was going into overtime, was beginning to spill into the prime time of television broadcasts. Now, I'll back up for a second and talk about one of the other reasons why this is such a great football game. Football was not, in 1958, the huge successful sport in America, or at least on the professional level, that it is today. It was definitely belonged to a sort of second tier of public interest. In fact, this game, which was the best and most important game of the season, the championship game, being played in Yankee Stadium, the premier venue for professional football, didn't sell out. on December 28th, 1958. There had been a newspaper strike in New York, so even the normal coverage the game would have gotten was gone. There was a blackout on television, so that wasn't the reason why people weren't coming. It just was not that big a deal in 1958. Baseball was and had been for decades the preeminent pastime of the American people, and football was simply, at the time, a professional football in particular, a sport that was played in the off-season of baseball. And the great football teams of the time played in baseball parks. This game took place in Yankee Stadium. And so television was Burt Bell, the commissioner of the NFL's big hope for the league. Television sets had begun appearing in American homes about 15 years before. And it was obviously hugely popular technology, and it multiplied exponentially year by year by year, so that I believe there were probably 2,000 or 3,000 television sets in people's houses in 1944. But by 1958, something like 95% of American homes had a television set in them. And most of those TV sets had 2 or 3 channels throughout the country. So when you talk about prime time on a Sunday night in 1958, it's not like prime time today where you have a choice of hundreds of different channels and a DVR, and so you can watch a show you recorded earlier in the week, or you can plop a DVD in or a VHS tape and watch an old movie. It was the only show in town. You know, what was on that set, you had 2 or 3 choices. And this, if you fell into that time slot, you were going to get more eyeballs than any thing in history had ever gotten. And that was true of anything that went on in primetime. So Burt Bell, in his wisdom, having written this sudden death overtime into the program, knew that if there ever was a championship game that went into overtime, that he had a chance of the promised land, which was Sunday night prime time. Well, that's what happened with this football game. When all those players got called back in to play this sudden death overtime, it had turned to night, and millions of Americans had come in from whatever they were doing on a Sunday afternoon and sat down in front of the TV set. The audience for this game by the end of the game was estimated to be 45 to 50 million people. This was far and away the biggest audience that any football game had ever had. And what they were about to see was a tremendously exciting finish to this classic football game. It was also an arresting visual image. And it was so because the game was televised in black and white. And I don't know if you're familiar with cinema noir. The famous sort of detective movies that are shot in black and white with very dramatic, high contrast lighting. There were cinematographers in Hollywood paid big money to make a movie look really exciting and dramatic. Well, this game looked like it had been lit by an Hollywood cinematographer. Because back in those days, nowadays if you go to an NFL football game, if it's a night game, they light up the arena like midday. It might as well be noon. I mean, you can get a suntan at 8 o'clock at night at Giant Stadium on a freezing winter evening. Back then, though, they didn't quite have the same high quality of illumination. They had banks of lights high up over Yankee Stadium, which did a perfectly good job of illuminating the field, but the stands were dark. And so if you've ever seen pictures of this game, and there are some in this book or any of the film footage of it, you've got these players battling it out on this brightly lit field against a totally black backdrop. Really weird. And then lining the sidelines, you have these dirty, beat-up players who've been, you know, in combat for several hours, bruised and tape hanging off of their hands, but they're all wearing capes that go down to like their ankles, and they're breathing steam. And I'm telling you that this looked like something no one had ever seen before. It looked like like some sort of medieval ritual being enacted on the field. So even if you were just flipping channels, you were going to keep watching for a little while because this was pretty dramatic to see. And then, of course, you had this fantastic finish of the game where Unitas led the Colts on not just one, but two dramatic 80-yard drives down the field, first to tie the game and then to win it. So many people watched this game, and it was so exciting that interest in professional football just took off. And you can trace the development of the league. It's almost like somebody literally lit a fuse, and then it just went up like a rocket. Within 2 years, there was such demand for football on television that a rival league, the American Football League, started up. And then within 3 years, I believe Johnny Unitas was paid something in the neighborhood of like $12,500 salary to play that year for the Colts. And within 3 years, the New York Jets were offering Joe Namath a bonus just to sign for more than $200,000. And that's because television really woke up to the potential for football, for live sports, but particularly football. And the story of the NFL, of course, over the next 20 or 30 years has been or 50 years it'll be in December, just this wedding of the media, medium football, or television with the game. There was no slow motion replays. There were no replays. It was televised with five cameras. One of the cameras was trained on an easel that had flashcards on which were written first quarter, second quarter, timeout, and so when the action stopped, they would go to that camera and it would explain what was going on. It was the custom in those days for fans to spill out of the stands at the end of football games and crowd around the edges of the field, and when the game was over, they would run out on the field and tear down the goalposts. And so as this game reached its climactic moment in overtime, with 50 million people watching on television and the fans all crowding around the field, somebody kicked the cable and unplugged America. Television sets went gray all over the country, right? Nowadays, obviously, if there was a technical problem at the Super Bowl, and the picture went dead, somebody would tap a referee on the head and the game would wait around until television got itself sorted out. Back in those days, television was just a spectator at the football game, and so there was no way they were going to stop the football game or would even be aware, that the cameras had all gone out. So the NBC executives producing this broadcast were quick thinking, and they sent a junior executive out on the field to pretend he was drunk. And he ran around out of the field. And he had actually played some college football, so he could move. And he kept the police on a wild goose chase for like 3 minutes until they finally hauled him down. And in the meantime, someone found the cable and reconnected America. And so no one missed a play. and it was reported afterwards for many years that a drunk had run out on the field. It was only years later when Chris Schenkel, who was the broadcaster for NBC, revealed that had actually been an employee of NBC who was sent out there to do that. The game was, it was important in terms of business, for the NFL. It was tremendously exciting. But it was also, and this is something I didn't realize until I began to study it, it's also a pivotal game in that illustrates the evolution of the game of football, because football was going through big changes in the late 1950s. It was transforming itself, frankly, into a far more interesting and complex sport. One of the big problems with football in previous years, particularly professional football, was the reluctance of the league to allow players and coaches to utilize the forward pass. Pro football was terrified of the forward pass because it had the look of a play that just couldn't be defended against, and whereby a team could just at will advance on the other team. It gave the offense too much of an advantage, they thought. So there were all these rules in place to restrict the use of the forward pass. And if you look back sometimes at old newsreel footage of football games, you remember there was a period, and I never understood this until I researched this book, but there was a period where the lines on the field weren't just horizontal. They were also vertical. The field was cross-hatched. And the reason it was is that one of the early rules to restrict the forward pass was that the quarterback was not allowed to throw the ball any more than 5 yards to his left or to his right. And so those lines were on the field so that referees could more easily determine if a pass was a legal pass or an illegal pass. But it was only in the late 1940s, actually with the a rival football league called the All-American Football Conference, which fully allowed the forward pass, that offenses began to utilize fully the potential. Paul Brown was the probably the first of the professional coaches to really integrate passing into an offense. The position of wide receiver, which is so much a part of football as we know it, was invented in 1949, I believe, by Clark Shaughnessy, who was one of the AAFC coaches. So by 1958, we're still very early into the integration of the pass into pro football. Now, before you had the passing game, one of the problems with pro football is if you got two evenly matched teams who were basically just running and trying to stop runners, you would sometimes get whole games that were like rugby scrums, you know, where the two teams would just be in a mass in the middle of the field that would sort of gradually move this way, and then it was boring to watch. But the pass just totally opened up the field, and so in one play, a quarterback could score a touchdown from the complete opposite end of the field, which made for a much more exciting kind of game. But it made also for tremendous difficulties for the defense. And, you know, there were two ways of defending. You know, you could line up in a pass defense or you could line up in a run defense. But if you had a team that could do both equally well on almost every play, you were in trouble because a clever coach or quarterback would find a way to exploit whichever formation you decided to get in. So in 1958, actually it had started a few years earlier, the New York Giants had experimented with and developed a new kind of defense, which was invented by Tom Landry, who was the assistant coach for the New York Giants. He was the defensive coordinator, and he called it the 4-3 defense, which of course is today the prototype. It is the basic pro defense. But in order to run a 4-3 defense, Landry recognized that he needed kind of a super player in the middle of the field. He needed a player who was big enough to be a lineman, basically to stop, to fend off an offensive lineman and tackle someone on a run, and yet fast enough and athletic enough to drop back and cover someone, a running back who pops out and runs a passing route. And so the Giants had a player named Sam Huff, who they had drafted as an offensive lineman. But Huff, who was a tremendous athlete, was too small to play on the offensive line in the pros. He had been an outstanding offensive lineman in college, University of West Virginia, I believe it was. He came from West Virginia. And they drafted him, but it was obvious in practice that he was overmatched by the much bigger defensive lineman. He made the team, but he was really struggling, and he didn't really have a place. And so Landry recognized that this Huff might well be the prototype of what he was looking for. He was a tremendous athlete. He was really big. There wasn't a role for him, but it just so happened Tom Landry had just invented a new role. So he approached Huff and said, "I'd like you to try this position. I want you to try and play middle linebacker." And Huff told him, "Well, I've never played, you know, that position before." And Landry said, "That's no problem. We've never run this defense before. I'm going to invent this defense around you." And so Landry and Huff, surrounded by a lot of extraordinarily talented football players, created the 4-3 defense and became champions of the NFL in 1956. They didn't win in 1957, but they were back in the championship game this year in 1958. And they were very worthy adversaries to the Baltimore Colts. Now, the Colts were coached by a fellow named Weeb Eubank, who had coached with Paul Brown in Cleveland. And Weeb Eubank had absorbed Paul Brown's methods, which were extraordinary, not just in integrating the passing game, but also training football players, educating them, running a complex offense, basically engaging football players at a a mental level that they hadn't in the past been used in a way that they hadn't been used in the past. And he was fortunate in lots of ways, Wee Bubank was. One of them was, probably the most significant in my opinion, was when he took in the 20th round of the draft in 1954, a section of the draft they don't even have anymore today. They called it a futures round, where you picked players who weren't even ready to come out of college yet, but you kind of put dibs on them for the future in case they might turn out to be draft worthy. And it was really a throwaway category, because in those days, NFL teams didn't have, you know, videotaped highlights of players from colleges all over the country, and didn't have scouting staffs that traveled around the country and you know, spent all year planning, you know, who they wanted to pick. A lot of it was pretty blind, the selection of football players, particularly when you got down to the 20th round. Well, they picked this wide receiver from SMU named Raymond Berry, who had, as a junior, and he was just a junior at SMU, he had caught only like 5 passes. He hadn't even played for the team until he was a junior. There was nothing about Raymond that anyone else recognized. And in fact, to this day, Raymond doesn't understand, and no one has ever been able to explain to him how or why the Baltimore Colts drafted him, because he hadn't shown anything. I asked him about it, and he said, well, you know, one or two of those, like 5 catches, were pretty good ones. And there was this sports writer from the Dallas Morning News, and he might have written something up, you know, that somebody saw, or maybe it was, you know, his father, Ray Berry, who was the high school coach in Paris, Texas, knew somebody, or maybe it was one of the quarterbacks who threw to him in practice who had seen. But it was the longest of long shots, right? And Raymond himself was the longest of long shots. He was a guy who was, he was a capable athlete, without a doubt, but he was nowhere near the kind of athlete who played professional football, even in the 1950s. He was relatively slow compared to the people he was playing against. He was slender, not a particularly strong guy, not particularly tall. He was nearsighted at a time when he was starting to play. They didn't have contact lenses, so he basically played kind of blind. He eventually was a sort of a pioneer in the use of contact lenses. But Raymond had decided he was going to be a professional football player. Now, even his father, who was the coach of his high school team, didn't let him play until he was a senior in high school, right? But he knew Raymond understood the game, so he had his son call the plays in the huddle, even though he was playing as wide receiver. Raymond made up his mind that the only position that he could make the pros at was as wide receiver. And he set out to make himself into a great wide receiver. And he did. He embarked on some of the most eccentric methods that anyone had ever seen in pro football. In fact, his teammates at the Baltimore Colts all thought he was a nut. This was a time in the 1950s, admittedly, when ideas of how to get in shape were primitive at best. Dietary restrictions. People didn't know, you know, how to strengthen themselves, how to build themselves up. Pro football players were told in the 1950s never to lift weights. Lifting weights would exercise the wrong muscles, they were told. And they were also told not to run, because running would also exercise the wrong muscles. And in fact, you know, the hardcore football coaches believed that the only way to really get in shape to play football was playing football, right? Only Raymond, you know, how was he going to play football all by himself? He wanted in the off season. He made the team, the Colts, and he played 1 year, and he did so poorly that he knew they were going to cut him after the next training camp. So he set about to do everything he could to make the team in his second year. So one of the things he determined to do was to get himself in playing shape. So when training camp started, he would have an edge. Only how do you get in playing shape if you can't play? Well, what Raymond did was he took a stopwatch, he bought himself a 16-millimeter film projector, and he watched whole football games, and he would just watch the wide receivers, and he would note every route that a wide receiver ran in a football game. He would note how far downfield they went, exactly what route they ran, how long it took them to trot back, how long they stayed in the huddle, then line up, run your next route. And then after a certain number of plays, you would come off the field, you'd get to rest for a few minutes while the defense was on the field. Then you would go back out, and you'd start all over again, and you'd run your routes. Some of your routes were short ones, some of them were long ones. Had it all mapped out on a piece of paper with the timings, with his stopwatch. And so he would go out to the high school field in Paris, Texas, where he was from, and he would put his little crib sheet down on the grass, and he would run in. He would run an entire football game in pantomime by himself, carrying a football. If anyone had seen him, they would have thought that this was a crazy man out in the summer sun by himself on the field, you know, getting down in three-point position, running out 10 yards, doing a little dance, cutting inside, trotting back, standing like he's in a huddle, going back, checking his little crib sheet, running another route, you know, coming back. But he did this every day until he got himself in football shape. I could go on and on about Raymond's methods. Another one of Raymond's remarkable approaches was he realized that when you caught footballs, you position your hands in certain ways. And so depending on where the ball is thrown to you, you have to turn your hands in different ways. So if you're trying to catch a pass that's thrown high, let's say over your left shoulder, you hold your hands like this, right? If you're trying to catch a pass that's coming high over your right shoulder, you have a different way of holding your hands. If it's a high pass, your hands are held differently. If it's a low pass, you turn your hands this way. So all these different ways of catching had different ways of positioning your hands. So Raymond broke this all down and named each hand position, right? And then after practice, he would get poor John Unitas or some other teammate to throw him 10 passes to every spot so that he would then very consciously practice 10 times each hand position he needed to catch the ball. When you start realizing these things about Raymond, when you learn these things, you realize why he became the greatest receiver in the NFL. He not only made the team, he went on to become the best receiver in the NFL. And I think if you read the story of this game, you see he actually was the key player in this victory for the Baltimore Colts. And he's also the player who elevated John Unitas to be the great quarterback that Unitas became. Because Unitas was a tremendous athlete and a great quarterback, no doubt. And he had a gut feel for the game. And he was going to be a good quarterback if he was ever given the chance to play. But the guy who gave him a chance to play was Webb Eubank. And the guy who he was throwing the ball to primarily was Ray Berry. And Raymond Berry had made such a study of the passing game. He bought at that little 16-millimeter projector, he would spend his nights while his teammates were out drinking beer or working their second jobs at night. Raymond would be in his apartment studying every single route he had run against the cornerback he was going to be playing against the following week, or watching other wide receivers and memorizing the routes they ran and the moves they made, planning for every game that he was about to play. For this game, well, actually, I should go back. When I talked to Raymond down in Tennessee, where he lives, he played in the NFL for 13 years, and he has binders, these sort of weathered old three-ring binders on a shelf, one for each year that he played. And inside those binders with little dividers is the notes he took in preparation for every game that he played. And so for this game, one game, he had 25 pages of handwritten notes from his study. This is not for the team. This is just Raymond's study for how he was going to play, how he was going to move in this game, including little hand-drawn routes for every one of the passing routes that he planned to run in that game, and every route that he had ever run against Carl Karolewicz, the cornerback he was going to play against, and those routes that he had noted in other game films that were successful against Carl Karolewicz. So he knew this guy who was going to be defending him better than this guy knew himself. And it wasn't just for Karolewicz, it was also for Harlan Sverre, the outside linebacker, who would sometimes drift over and pick up a wide receiver on a route. So John Unitas found himself in league with this nutcase, Raymond Berry, who I think elevated Unitas to levels that he would never have reached otherwise. Because Unitas was not the sort of person like Barry to spend all of his nights studying film in his living room. But Raymond would drag him in, knowing that this was a team. This was a teamwork. This was a partnership that they had to have. And he educated Unitas in what he wanted to do. It got to be so that when the Colts planned their games, Weeb Eubank would draw up the plan for the offense, and then he and John would go see Raymond and ask Raymond what he wanted to do that game. And Raymond would say, well, here's what we're going to do, you know, here's what I'm going to do. And then they would integrate Raymond's game into their game plan, and that's how they would do it. And at the critical moment of this game, in the third quarter when the Colts are about to lose, they have the ball with less than 2 minutes to play, and they're 80 yards away from scoring. And Tom Landry is running the defense against them. Now, Landry is probably the smartest defensive coach in pro football. And Landry's whole defense, his whole theory of defense, is centered around the idea of anticipation, knowing what the other guy is going to do so well that you are there, that you're there before the ball gets there. And he had had tremendous success with getting inside the heads of the quarterback of the other team and anticipating what they were going to do. So here they are in the final 2 minutes, and Landry and Huff are on the sidelines planning, you know, their defense. And Landry figures, I know exactly what Unitas is going to do. He's going to throw the ball to Raymond Berry. He's been killing us with Raymond Berry this whole game. Raymond was the master of the 10-yard out route. And when you're trying to beat the clock, you want to stop the clock, so you're running to the sidelines every pass. So he knew that Unitas was going to throw the ball to Raymond Berry. So Landry decided, I don't know what they're going to do to us otherwise, but we are going to take away Raymond Berry. We're just not going to allow that to happen. And so he took Harlan Sverry, his outside linebacker, and moved him all the way out to line him up nose to nose on Raymond Berry. So Raymond now had a linebacker right across the line from him, which was highly unusual. And then 10 yards behind the linebacker, the cornerback. So he's double teamed, and he's got a big linebacker right in front of him whose job is take him out of the play, right? So he's already lined up out here. Well, he looks over at Unitas. Now, years before, and Raymond emphasized that he couldn't even remember when the moment was or what game it had been from, but years earlier, he and Unitas, in one of their marathon film sessions, had seen somebody do this. They were watching a game, and an outside linebacker moved all the way out and lined up nose-to-nose on the wide receiver. And so they had watched that and said, well, that's really weird. You know, no one's ever done that to us before. What are we going to do if anybody ever does that to us? And they had agreed that if that ever happened to them, that whatever the play call was, they were going to scrap it. And Raymond was going to just take two steps to the outside and then run like a bat out of hell across the middle of the field, that empty space vacated by the linebacker who just moved all the way out wide. And so Raymond, in the din of Yankee Stadium and the exciting final 2 minutes of the NFL championship game, looks over at Unitas. They don't have time to speak to one another. And he's wondering, does John remember? And he said, well, you know, this is what we agreed to do. So I'm watching the film, and there it is. Raymond, two steps to the outside, slants across the middle. Unitas hits him in stride. He runs 27 yards for a first down into Giants territory. Now, no time to huddle, you know, and now you got to figure Tom Landry is going crazy. You know, how in the world, you know, do the Colts have a counter move, you know, to this play, this weird curve that he just threw at them? It set the Giants so off stride that Raymond caught the following two passes and moved them down to where they kicked the field goal at the end of the game. And then the Colts won the game in overtime on a play after Raymond had caught several more passes and moved them further upfield. And poor Sam Huff, who's running this Giants defense, he's like a fighter who keeps getting hit by the same left jab, you know, the same punch over and over and over again. So that happens to you as a fighter, and you begin to forget your technique. You kind of panic, and you start to make adjustments, saying, well, you know, I got to do something to stop this guy from hitting me with the left. And, of course, what you're doing when you make those little adjustments is you're opening yourself up for a big right hand. And Unitas is watching as on each play, Sam Huff, each time he completes a pass to Raymond Berry, Huff starts cheating a little bit more and more out to the right. And Unitas has the perfect counter move to that. So in the critical play in the sudden death overtime, he calls a trap up the middle with Alan Ameche that sends the right end of the tight end on the right side for the Colts, who slides off his block and just runs across the backfield and nails the middle linebacker. Well, ordinarily, Huff would have been right there in the middle of the line to tackle Ameche as he came through, but Unitas knew that because he was cheating a little to the right, he was not going to be able to react fast enough. And then by the time he'd figured out that he'd been fooled, he was about to get run over by a freight train of a right end who had taken a big running start across the backfield. And if you watch this play on film, it is just like Walt Disney drew it up in a cartoon. I mean, Sam Huff, I talked to Sam Huff about this, and this is partly my description of what happened is partly based on Sam's memory of this. And it's interesting contrasting Raymond Berry remembering these plays with great excitement and pleasure, and Sam Huff remembering them with great excitement and anger. And 50 years later, Sam Huff is still a very big and vital guy with an arm span that could wrap three people. And he stands up behind his desk and that goddamn Unitas, you know, he was inside my head. He knew everything I was thinking. And he's still mad about it 50 years later. So, as you see, this was tremendous fun for me to do. Meeting these old football players was a pleasure. I grew up part of my childhood in Baltimore, and I remember this team. I remember John Unitas and Gino Marchetti and Artie Donovan and all these wonderful characters, and many of whom, thankfully, are still alive and well, and vivid memories of this game. And it really is a testament, even though a lot of them are debilitated and some of them have bad knees, but they just are so happy and excited to be reminded of the years that they played football and the joy that they have in those memories and in the friendships that last today, till today, you know, it just defined their lives. I'll tell you one more quick little anecdote, and then if you have any questions, I'll try and answer them. But to give you an idea of the enduring nature of these friendships, Artie Donovan, who was affectionately known as Fatso, and who is actually one of the most delightful characters that you'll ever meet. He's actually made a second career on television and radio as a comedian because David Letterman used to invite him on all the time because he's just got one hilarious anecdote after the other. I'm interviewing Jim Mutchler, who was the great tight end for the Colts in this game. And Jim started his own insurance business and very successfully after he played football. And he's now kind of in a semi-retirement. He's got a big plush office out in Hunt Valley in Maryland. And as we go into his office, he tells his secretary, you know, hold my calls. You know, I don't want anybody interrupting it. I want to talk to this guy. So we're in his office talking. So he hears the knock, knock, knock. And the secretary opens the door and sticks her head in. I'm sorry, Mr. Mutchler, but I know you said not to interrupt you, but there's somebody who keeps calling, and he says just to tell you it's the Pope. And so Jim looks at me and he says, Donovan. So, I mean, and again and again, when I would run into these guys, you'd see how close they are with one another. So thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for David Robolewski, Jeff Shara, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 3rd, 2008.